Another viral outbreak. Alarm bells are raised in West Africa over a relative of Ebola, the Marburg virus.
The most concerning thing about this outbreak in Ghana is that this is not a typical place that it's located.
Also today, Brazil's drift toward evangelical power in politics. We meet one of the big players behind that push.
O Estado é laico.
This is a secular country, but I am terribly Christian, says Cabinet Secretary Damaris Alves. Plus a heat wave and flooding in China, one country's new reality with climate change.
You know, more intense periods of shortage and more intense periods of flood.
And remembering a pop art icon of the 1960s whose outsized sculptures of everyday items couldn't help but make a smile.
The only thing that really saves the human experience is humor.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it here. Russian President Vladimir Putin is in Tehran today. Concerns are mounting that Russia is trying to buy hundreds of drones from Iran to use against Ukraine. Just hours ago, he met with Iran's hardliner president, Ibrahim Raisi, as well as Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the leader of Turkey and a member of NATO. As Russia and Iran grow closer, the meetings also have repercussions for both Syria and Ukraine. The world's Duri Buscarin joins me from Istanbul to untangle all of this. Hey, Duri.
Hi, Marco.
So 5 months into the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and this is President Vladimir Putin's first trip since then that's outside of the former Soviet Union. What does he hope to accomplish in Iran?
So this is Putin's highest profile visit since the invasion of Ukraine, and the optics here are top of mind for him. I spoke to Sanam Vakil, who directs the Middle East program at Chatham House. She says Putin wants to show that he's not as isolated as the West would like him to be.
Tehran would like to maintain a neutral posture, but again, the symbolic nature of this meeting and the embrace of Putin in Tehran strongly suggests that Tehran isn't neutral, and Tehran is playing a longer geopolitical game.
Vakil says Iran is orienting itself more closely with Russia and China, and this is important because it comes right after U.S. President Biden's trip to the Middle East.
Well, Biden strongly stated that he wasn't going to abandon the region to Russia, China, and Iran.
Yesterday, Putin's foreign affairs advisor called Iran an important partner and said that Russia and Iran share, quote, a desire to take their relations to a new level of strategic partnership. But there's still some tension here. I mean, Western sanctions on Russian oil have pushed the country to cut its prices and sell to countries like China, which in turn are undercutting Iranian and Venezuelan fuel exports.
So the three leaders met today, Putin, Raisi of Iran, and Erdogan of Turkey. What do we know about what they discussed?
The official reason for this visit was for Putin, Erdogan, and Raisi to discuss the so-called Astana peace process in Syria. The three countries are backing different sides in the country. Russia and Iran support the Damascus regime, and Turkey is backing Syrian opposition groups in the north. Erdogan has announced plans to attack another section of northern Syria that's controlled by Kurdish militias affiliated with the PKK. He's hoping Russia and Iran won't interfere, says Doreen Khalifa, senior Syria analyst for the crisis group.
Where Russia constantly objects to new Turkish incursions into the area. As it sees it, it undermines Damascus's potential control over these areas in the future, even though in the past they have implicitly at least green-lighted.
According to the readout, Khamenei said military action would harm both Turkey and Syria, but that Iran would cooperate with Turkey to fight terrorism. And it's unclear if Erdogan will take this as a green light, because Turkey labels the Kurdish militias in northern Syria as part of the PKK and therefore part of a terrorist group. Turkey's expected attack is part of a longer-term effort that's been happening where the country is occupying sections of Syria and pushing refugees who have been living in Turkey for years to return to Syria.
Yeah, it is a complex geopolitical puzzle for Russia, Iran, and Turkey. The war in Ukraine, though, I mean, it is top of mind for these three countries. What happens when Russia and Iran are drawing closer?
So Iran has denied recent U.S. reports that it is preparing to sell armed drones to Russia. But on Saturday, the Biden administration released satellite images showing Russian officials visiting Iran's Kashan airfield to examine a showcase of unmanned aerial vehicles capable of carrying precision-guided missiles. I spoke to Ali Vaez, the senior Iran analyst for the crisis group, and he says Iran's Shahed 119 drone, that's what they were looking at, is based on the American drone that Iran shot down way back in 2011.
That triggered Iran's drone program, which has now turned into one of the
most advanced drone programs in the region.
Beyond these drones, trade in general has been increasing between Iran and Russia since the invasion of Ukraine. Iran has a lot of experience with Western sanctions, and analysts believe that these sanctioned countries can band together to help each other weather the storm.
That's Duri Buscarin in Istanbul for The World. Duri, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Evangelical Christians in Brazil have been big supporters of President Jair Bolsonaro. They've also played important roles serving in his government. One of the most prominent evangelicals is Damaris Elvas. In recent years, she's become a political mover and shaker, rising to the level of cabinet minister, and now she's set her sights even higher. In the second of our five-part series about religion and nationalism in Brazil, Michael Fox has this profile.
Damaris Elvas worked in politics for years, but most Brazilians really first noticed her in 2019 when this video went viral. It's a shaky cell phone video. She's surrounded by supporters. Attention everyone, she says. It's a new era in Brazil. Boys wear blue and girls wear pink. That was right after President Jair Bolsonaro appointed Elvas to be his Minister of Women, Family, and Human Rights. Her statement set the tone for her tenure in government. As minister, she worked quickly to transform that idea into reality. She blocked campaigns in support of LGBTQ and gender rights, rolled back previous human rights policies, and remodeled her ministry in defense of Christian values.
O Estado é laico, mas essa ministra é terrivelmente cristã.
This is a secular country, Elvas said during her inauguration speech, but I am terribly Christian. And being Christian, I believe in God's designations and God's proposals, and God has brought a team together here in this ministry. For conservative evangelicals, this was a huge moment. Victor Araújo is a Brazilian political scientist at the University of Zurich.
Que os evangélicos, eles têm uma visão de que eles devem expandir o reino de Deus.
He says, evangelicals in Brazil have the vision that they should expand the kingdom of Jesus wherever they are. And she personifies an agenda that is really important for the evangelicals linked to the question of values. Damaris Elvas is a lawyer by training. She helped form an anti-abortion group and cut her teeth in politics for 20 years as a congressional advisor. She worked as a political aide to congressmen and senators. She is also an evangelical pastor, charismatic and emotional, with a gift for oratory that she inherited from her father, himself a Pentecostal pastor who founded close to 100 churches across Brazil. Here she is speaking to a packed church audience about how Jesus saved her from committing suicide when she was a child. I saw Jesus approaching from the goyaba tree, she said. I had an extraordinary revelation. Elvas transformed the Ministry of Human Rights. She blocked family planning policies like distributing condoms and instead pushed campaigns calling for abstinence until marriage. She helped organize local activists to protest against abortion, which is legal in Brazil only in extreme circumstances.
Oi, gente. No próximo domingo, dia 6 de outubro, é dia de eleição em todo o Brasil.
Her most lasting political success might be at the local level. Elvas worked to encourage evangelicals to get involved with thousands of local elections. The themes she emphasized were childhood protection and education. She released this video ahead of the 2019 elections, where she tells Brazilians to get out and vote and remember to pick people committed to protecting youth. Her organizing brought results. In many cities, including Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, evangelicals won a majority of the seats on local councils dedicated to childhood protection and education. Rodrigo Toniol is a social scientist at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro.
Ela conseguiu colocar para dentro a massa.
She was able to bring the mass of evangelicals inside her ministry and the government, he says, and not big politicians, but regular people. Elvas has been praised by Brazil's faithful, but her work at the Ministry of Women, Family, and Human Rights has not gone over well with many Brazilians. Her political polar opposite would be Congresswoman Maria do Rosário.
Todas as formas de amor e de vida e
That's her speaking out in Congress in defense of gender diversity and LGBTQ rights. Do Rosário is a longtime lawmaker with the Workers' Party, who herself ran Brazil's Secretary of Human Rights from 2011 through 2014. That was under the leftist presidency of Dilma Rousseff. Do Rosário spoke to the news outlet Brazil 247 last year, and she denounced Elvas for dismantling public policies that support human rights.
Eles estão desmontando tudo cada uma das políticas, para ser mais concreto.
They're taking everything apart, she said. Every one of the state policies, confronting modern-day slavery, dismantled. The national programs protecting human rights defenders and victims of violence, dismantled. National programs for youth and women. Damares doesn't even apply the budget, she said. According to a report released earlier this year, Alves's ministry used less than half its funding in 2021, rolling back resources for campaigns and refusing to pay third-party groups contracted by the government to support victims of domestic violence or prevent attacks against the LGBTQ community. This directly impacts the protection of women and the fight for gender rights, says Tatiana Bezerra, a social anthropology doctoral student at the Federal University of Santa Catarina. Bezerra walks an interesting line herself as both a feminist and an evangelical.
Que consiste, basicamente, em impedir.
She says, Alves has worked hard at the ministry to stop any substantial human rights public policies from advancing, be it in favor of abortion, sex education, combating gender inequality, or promoting racial equality or indigenous rights. That, at least in part, has lifted Alves to stardom among many evangelicals in Brazil, and she is poised to cash in on that support. With Bolsonaro behind in the polls for this year's election, Damares Alves left her cabinet position in March and announced her pre-candidacy for the Senate.
Eu aceitei esse desafio para ganhar esta eleição que vai ter.
I accepted this challenge to win this election, she said, and to become the first female leader of the Senate. With the growing influence of evangelicals across Brazil and Alves's image as Bolsonaro's minister of family values, she just might get there. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
This story is part of a regular series of reports called Sacred Nation, looking at religion and nationalism around the world. Thanks to the Henry Luce Foundation for funding the project. Check out the other stories in the series on our website, theworld.org/sacrednation. Klaus Oldenburg, the master pop artist, died yesterday in his adopted home of New York City. As an icon of the avant-garde art world from the 1960s on, he was known for his oversized sculptures of everyday objects, commissioned by cities all over the globe, from South Korea to the Netherlands. He was born in Stockholm in 1929, but made his home in the U.S., which provided the cultural artifacts that inspired him. From a giant pair of vinyl cheeseburgers to a typewriter eraser nearly 20 feet high. In 1966, the public TV series USA Artist profiled Oldenburg, and he spoke of his love of vinyl as a material that he used to create those cheeseburgers, or bathtubs and toilets.
The fact of porcelain or enamel, that it looks so much like a patent vinyl, and it's possible to make something out of vinyl that looks like soft porcelain.
Which he did a lot. Klaus Oldenburg was on a mission to recreate a catalog of the beauty we miss in everyday things. In his 1963 work, French Fries and Ketchup, each vinyl French fry is about 4 feet long. They are covered by a monster splat of ketchup, also in vinyl. All of it stuffed with kapok, like throw pillows, comfortable enough to lie down in, but also so cartoon-like that you want to laugh. For Klaus Oldenburg, as he said 10 years ago, that was always the point.
The only thing that really saves the human experience is humor. I think without humor, it wouldn't be much fun.
Sculptor Klaus Oldenburg was 93. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Morocco and Israel are enjoying warming relations right now. The chief of Israel's armed forces was in Morocco yesterday to discuss security ties. Reports say Israel is also now likely to sell Morocco weapons. 2 years ago, Morocco and Israel normalized relations under the so-called Abraham Accords. With us to discuss all this is Intisar Fakir. She directs the Middle East Institute's North Africa and Sahel program from Washington. How big a deal is it that Israel's chief of the armed forces visited Morocco, Intisar?
I think it's overall, it's remarkable, really, the extent and really the intensity with which both Morocco and Israel have sort of embraced each other and have gone about implementing this new bilateral relationship and building it in a fairly short period of time.
I mean, I see there's been growing military ties since the normalization of relations between Morocco and Israel. A Moroccan commando unit was hosted by Israel for a multi-nation exercise last July. The two countries officially established direct military ties in March of this year. What do you think each side is getting out of the military relationship at this point?
I think they're each getting a lot. I think this boosts Israel's image and diplomatic acceptance, particularly among Arab partners. I think the relationship also gives Morocco a lot of leverage in terms of its foreign policy, in terms of its own relationships with other partners, particularly when dealing with the U.S. It gives Morocco also greater diplomatic and security weight regionally. I think overall, this will really help Morocco play a bigger role in North Africa and the entire African continent. Right now, I think the security and military element of it also helps Morocco kind of project more international support, particularly given the tension that Morocco has with Algeria.
Intisar, you mentioned tensions between Morocco and neighboring Algeria. I mean, they've been long at odds over the Western Sahara, a disputed territory claimed by Sahrawi rebels. How do Morocco's ties with Israel strengthen its position vis-a-vis Algeria?
I think it signals to Algeria that Morocco is militarily capable and able to kind to counter any potential attacks, any increase in tension that might sort of turn into an actual fighting. So I think there is the kind of military element of it. There is also the element that, you know, Morocco has the support of all of the major security actors. You know, it has the international support from the US, from the EU, from Israel. So I think all of that really sends a pretty powerful message to Algeria. I think it also carries with it a little bit of a risk in that it risks antagonizing Algeria further. So we will see how Algeria responds to, you know, all of these deals that Morocco has been making with Israel and these increase in visits and the growing military and intelligence cooperation as well.
Yeah, generally, Intisar, I mean, if these ties between Israel and Morocco continue to grow, what do you think that would mean for the region?
Morocco has been trying to emerge as a key regional actor. And this was particularly the case, you know, before the transition happened in Algeria in 2019. And now we see Algeria trying to counter that. So I think this growing rivalry between Algeria and Morocco adds another layer of instability regionally. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays domestically. So far, it's been, I think, on the whole, beneficial both for Morocco and Algeria to have this kind of threat, this sort of looming threat. It's helped sort of bolster the regimes domestically. But it'll be interesting to see at what point this might kind of play against them domestically as well as a potential destabilizing factor.
I know the Jewish community has had a long history in Morocco. How large is it today, and does that play any role in the closening of these relations?
I think the Moroccan diaspora in Israel is upwards of a million people claim heritage back in Morocco. You know, this is a population that likes to go back to Morocco, to visit Morocco. You know, they spend money in Morocco. So I think that's an important relationship there too. And that's certainly been an important element in how the importance of these bilateral ties have been positioned domestically as well.
Intisar Fakir is a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Institute, North Africa and Sahel program. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Intisar, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Concerning news out of Ghana in West Africa, two people are confirmed dead from an Ebola-related virus. Presence of the highly infectious Marburg virus was confirmed by the World Health Organization on Sunday. Health officials in Ghana moved swiftly to quarantine nearly 100 people who might have been exposed. Dr. Colleen Kraft, an infectious disease physician at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, joins us. She was on the first team to treat Ebola cases in the U.S. back in 2014. Dr. Kraft, what do we know so far about this outbreak of Marburg virus in Ghana?
Yes, so the most concerning thing about this outbreak in Ghana is that this is not a typical place that it's located. And that's what usually gives us great concern as a global community, is that when these filoviruses or these hemorrhagic fevers occur in places that are not used to seeing these types of diseases.
Right, so Ghana recently fell into the classification of middle-income country. What do you mean when you say it's not a typical place where you'd find Marburg?
So Marburg has been seen in many different countries. It actually was first described in Serbia and Marburg, Germany, and that was from importation of primates from Africa. But typically, people have not had Marburg in the country of Ghana in the past.
So two people have died, nearly 100 people quarantined. What does that tell us about the severity of this outbreak?
This is not unexpected for this type of virus, but to me, the fact that they are already quarantining 100 people is a very, very quick response to this virus that is in this country that's not used to dealing with it.
When a human is infected with Marburg, what are the symptoms?
So they're very similar to Ebola virus. Fever, chills, you can have muscle aches and pains. Those are all very common to all viruses or most viruses. But then about the third day in, you can have diarrhea, abdominal pain, and cramping. And then, you know, you just really become dehydrated. And these hemorrhagic manifestations that I think are often very prominent in the description of these viruses, you know, have to do from people having a sepsis syndrome or their blood products are being broken down in their bodies. And so that's why they get spontaneous bleeding.
So is there a vaccine or cure or any treatment that is reliable?
No. So similar to other hemorrhagic fevers, these have occurred so rarely that there hasn't really been sort of a motivation to have a vaccine or a treatment against this. So right now, the treatment would be supportive care, which is really getting the person to survive through the part where they're the most sick in order to have their own body take care of it.
So to the west of Ghana in 2014, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, as we mentioned a moment ago, a serious outbreak of Ebola, a relative of Marburg. How equipped is Ghana to take on a similar virus like Marburg?
I think Ghana has already shown us that they're highly equipped, that they are already very proactively quarantining. You know, a lot of being able to contain these viruses is coordination and also trust in the government. And so I think Ghana is able to basically prevent more people from coming in contact with the contacts of these individuals.
Is there anything to suggest, Dr. Kraft, that this outbreak could reach the scope of the 2014 Ebola outbreak in the region?
I certainly hope not. I think that the region of West Africa is still recovering from the tragedy within the tragedy that happened with Ebola virus disease. This rapid response and sort of what will likely be a global response, sort of containment and support, I think they will do a great job in containing this virus.
We've been speaking with Dr. Colleen Kraft about an outbreak of Marburg virus in Ghana. She's an infectious disease physician in Atlanta and was treating Ebola cases in the U.S. in 2014. Dr. Kraft, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to The World. This fall, Russian children will be encouraged to join a new patriotic youth movement, part of Putin's efforts to steer Russians away from Western influence. Our guest in Moscow has this prediction: the kids won't abide.
A year from now, they would be spitting and hating, and they would be watching TikTok videos at school somewhere in the bathroom.
Later this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Officials in the United Kingdom today warn the public to use caution. That's because of the extreme heat that's hitting large parts of England. Continental Europe is also seeing heat-related deaths and wildfires burning out of control. On the other side of the globe, more record high temperatures in China. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai. How hot is it there, Rebecca? What are you looking at?
Well, last week, the temperatures here in Shanghai reached 105 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the hottest it's been in almost 150 years. If you remember, Shanghai is still recovering from a two-month lockdown, COVID lockdown, and so there's still concerns about cases here, so the city is doing regular mass testings. And last week, on one of the hottest days, I was so shocked because when I went to get tested, the people doing the testing were obviously in poor physical condition. They were wearing even more protective gear than I remember them wearing during the lockdown. They had on masks, goggles, shields, full hazmat suits, and they're sitting on these giant blocks of ice under their feet to cool them off. I couldn't believe it. They looked like they were about to faint.
I saw that photograph and I was stunned. I mean, so this heat is not common at all.
I mean, it is. It's hot every summer here, but these heat waves are just getting more and more common. And it's not just Shanghai, though. There have been record-breaking high temperatures all the way across the country, all the way out to the western city of Chongqing. And there's been these videos going around of like roads buckling in Jiangxi province and this museum roof in Chongqing that just melted and collapsed in the heat.
That is incredible. How are ordinary folks dealing with this weather and just trying to stay cool? Is air conditioning a thing?
Yeah, well, for people who have to work outside, like delivery workers, they're just soldiering through it. But those who can are staying indoors and or anywhere with air conditioning. Today, it rained, so it cooled off a little bit. And once the rain stopped, I went outside and I spoke with a woman, Zhu Ming, who was out for an ice cream with her 6-year-old daughter. So she told me it's so hot, she's changed her schedule for her daughter. So her daughter sleeps later in the morning and then stays indoors until 6 p.m. when she finally goes out for some exercise. And this extreme heat is supposed to continue till late August, with temperatures possibly reaching 107 degrees. So with all that air conditioning, you can imagine the power grid is being strained. Last week, state media reported that China's power load hit an all-time high of 1.2 billion kilowatts.
Yeah, and that may be another thing that China's going to have to deal with. Now, the heat isn't the only thing happening right now. There's been more flooding in China in recent weeks. What's going on there?
Yes, so this summer has once again seen a number of flash flooding incidents throughout China. Last month, there were record levels of rainfall in Guangxi and Guangdong provinces that forced hundreds of thousands of people to be evacuated and affected schools and businesses. And then just over the weekend, there were flash floods in Sichuan and Gansu provinces, and that killed at least 18 people and evacuated thousands more. I spoke with Scott Moore, who's a researcher at University of Pennsylvania. He's focused on China's water policies.
You know, it's essentially the third consecutive year of record-breaking flooding. It's certainly consistent with what, you know, has long been modeled, predicted, in some cases observed, climate-related effect. You know, I think it's fair to say that the extreme weather and especially extreme precipitation events are linked to climate change.
So last year around this time, Rebecca, there was massive flooding in central China. Is this just a repeat of a year ago, or has something changed?
Well, flooding in China, I mean, it goes way back in history. It's common, but it's hard not to notice the intensity of this flooding in recent years. I mean, last summer, people still cannot forget how awful that flooding was in central Henan province. The images of people in shoulder-deep water in the Zhengzhou city subway are still kind of seared on people's minds. And it really sounded a warning bell for them about the impacts of climate change. The flooding that's been playing out this summer hasn't produced those kind of dramatic images in urban areas, but they're are very significant. The areas that flooded over this past weekend, for example, got double their monthly rainfall in just 2 days. And so I was talking to Scott Moore. He says, looking forward, climate change is going to continue to lead to extreme weather events in China.
It's probably less about counting on there being record-breaking flooding every summer than just increased variability. So you're going to have, you know, more intense periods of shortage and more intense periods of flood.
I spoke with some other scientists, too. That's what they all agree on, that climate change is just exacerbating this intensity. So worse flooding and then worse drought. And that's going to have a deep impact, not just on agriculture, but also on China's economic development going forward, for sure.
And the government in Beijing, what's the messaging around the floods and the heat and these compounding problems?
Regarding the heat, the government in different provinces is asking people to conserve energy. There have been some provinces have been closing down factories to conserve energy. Regarding the flooding, I think the government is saying, you know, they're trying to address the issue, but this is just something that's, you know, this is not a freak incident. This is happening every year now. So that's what we're going to have to see going forward, what they're going to do.
The World's China correspondent, Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
It's not just people that have to worry about extreme heat. Infrastructure can also be at risk. Here to talk about the plight of bridges, railways, roads, and electrical grids that could buckle in the heat is Kostas Samaras. He's a senior advisor in the Biden White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy. I'd like to start in London, Kostas, with an example. The Hammersmith Bridge, it's now partially wrapped in protective foil because of the extreme heat there. What's going on? What's that supposed to do?
With this bridge and with nearly all of our infrastructure that's in place right now, it was really built for the climate of the 20th century, not the 21st century. So this bridge or airport runways or train tracks, these are all designed to do their jobs within a range of temperatures. And when conditions go outside those ranges, things can go wrong.
Is extreme heat mainly a problem with old bridges like the 150-plus-year-old Hammersmith Bridge? I mean, how big is the problem as you see it?
The challenge with extreme heat is specific types of bridges, might only have a little bit of tolerance for expansion. And like we're seeing in London, like we're seeing in many places, the extreme heat that is driven by climate change is driving some of this infrastructure beyond its design capacity.
When we think about the unexpected impacts of extreme climate on physical infrastructure, like rail lines or bridges or roads, is there one example that really took you by surprise?
A few years ago, I was at the airport in Washington, D.C., and we were waiting to take off, and we had to wait, and people had to get off the plane because the tarmac, the runway underneath of the plane, was starting to buckle because it was very hot. And it was very kind of ironic. You're in this airplane that is burning jet fuel that is going to contribute to climate change, but the infrastructure that is both contributing to and affected by climate change is right there in your face and very apparent.
Now, you focus on energy policy, Costa, and there's a lot of talk about making energy sustainable, but what about climate's impact on our energy infrastructure itself, like the wires, the electrical substations, the generators, stuff like that, that's being affected by a lot of air conditioners, for example?
Well, climate really does a number on our energy system. From the supply side, it can reduce the amount of power available in hydropower dams. It can make our power plants and power lines less efficient. And really, all of this is at a time when everybody needs to turn on their air conditioners to stay safe from extreme heat. Climate affects the supply, climate affects the transmission, and climate affects the demand. So we need an all-hands-on-deck approach to what we can do about this. We need to use the science to understand where the vulnerabilities are. We need to get to net zero emissions as soon as possible. We need to deploy a lot of clean energy that is resilient to climate impacts. And most importantly, we have to deploy nature-based solutions such as green infrastructure that can bring down temperatures in urban communities.
And what about knock-on effects from an impacted infrastructure? I think about transportation. We heard from our Europe correspondent yesterday about trains being canceled because rails are buckling under the heat. Do you imagine if that continues, what the impact will be on the labor force that commutes?
Well, this just goes to show you, Marco, that climate change is not just an environmental problem. It's an everything problem. Climate impacts affects the energy system, as we talked about, transportation system, the water system, food systems. And we as a society need to rapidly transition to net zero emissions, as well as making all of our human systems resilient to these impacts.
Costa Samaras is a senior advisor in the Biden White House, where he works in the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Costa, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
When Renata Flores was 13, she took part in an American Idol-style show in Peru. It got canceled, so she posted her song on YouTube. It was a cover of a British song in Quechua. The video exploded. Now, 8 years later, she's a rapper and a leader among a few Peruvian artists making music, often with a social message in the indigenous language. Flores releases her second album in a few weeks. Reporter Gisele Regatao went to Renata Flores' home studio in Peru to see how she's using hip-hop to fight discrimination.
Renata Flores looks like any 21-year-old. She's wearing ripped jeans, a bright green top, and colorful necklaces. Her hair is up in ponytails and braids. But she's working, putting final touches on a new song. Flores says this song is about the holiday celebrating Peru's independence, which is coming up next week.
En la sierra la independencia pues se logró después de muchísimo tiempo después de esa fecha.
In the Andes region where we are, she says, independence took much longer and came after a lot of fighting. Even today, she feels people here are not really free. Flores lives in Ayacucho. It's a 12-hour drive southeast of Lima. In the 80s, the city was the cradle of the Sendero Luminoso, or Shining Path, a communist guerrilla group. She says the new album is both personal and political. Yeah.
tener como una conexión de...
The new songs will have a connection with what I feel and also with Mother Earth. The planet is a living being, and I feel we're not treating it well, she says. Since releasing her first album last year, Flores has grabbed national and international attention. She had a small movie role and collaborated with popular Peruvian singers like Eva Ayón. She also scored a few corporate sponsorships.
It's very difficult to find like that mix from trap and hip-hop in Quechua. And una mujer que lo haga. Es difícil.
Rosa Chavez is a journalist who covers indigenous populations for the website Ojo Público in Peru. She says it's particularly hard for a woman to do what Flores does. Chavez says Flores evolved quickly as an artist. Her first album, Iscun, or Nine, places women as protagonists in Peru's history. Chavez says it was a turning point.
Encuentra como una propuesta, ¿no? Encuentra que tiene algo que decir.
Flores finds a purpose. She realizes she has something to say. Chavez says she follows that mission. Américo Mendoza Mori is a leading academic in Quechua at Harvard University.
Renata is not just becoming an advocate about the use of the language, but becoming an advocate on cultural reclamation.
He says Quechua is the most spoken indigenous language in the Americas. It's used by 10 million people. But it has long carried a stigma. He says that during Peru's civil war, 75% of those killed spoke an indigenous language.
At some point in our history, speaking Quechua or speaking an indigenous language could lead people to die.
Flores is part of a generation that didn't grow up speaking Quechua and is reconnecting with the culture. In her music video, she wears colorful indigenous clothing and they often feature traditional celebrations. Flores' path to music started with her parents. They used to be in a rock band, and her mom has a music school. The idea of singing in Quechua came from her mother, Patricia Rivera. She played a tape of a blues song in the indigenous language for her daughter.
Le gustó, yo le di la tarea para que ella lo versionara con el piano porque era su instrumento principal.
Rivera says Flores enjoyed the song, so she gave her homework to create a version for the piano.
Es una gran responsabilidad, no.
She says her daughter now carries a big responsibility.
Ya de ahí empezamos, ella empezó a investigar un poco más y también a hablar más con las abuelas.
She says Flores started investigating her ancestry and talking to her grandmothers. Rivera says up to that moment, she and her husband talked to their daughter in Spanish and would only use Quechua when trying to hide something from her. Flores now takes Quechua classes 3 times a week. Renata Flores has found a big following on social media. On YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok, but she still doesn't get radio play.
Yo creo que porque es en quechua, porque piensan que bueno no van a entender.
She says she believes that's because she sings in Quechua. The DJs say people won't understand it. That's one of the reasons she's using more Spanish in her new album.
Para que me entiendan, porque a veces como no me entienden, solo está en quechua.
She says she wants people to get the message. The message is clear. She's Quechuan and she's proud. For the world, I'm Gisele Regatao.
Gisele reported the story with Vera Holler. Want to know what songs our team here at The World is listening to this summer? We're jamming to tunes from Haiti, Morocco, Japan, Pakistan, and Venezuela, to name a few places. We've put together a Spotify playlist for you with our favorite songs of the summer from around the globe. Find a link on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. For Vladimir Putin, young Russians are key to the future. But to understand what that means now, we need to turn back the clock a few decades to the heyday of the Soviet Union. A youth group known as the Young Pioneers was on the march. Children with their red neckerchiefs and Vladimir Lenin badges were featured in parades. They spouted communist slogans at events. Membership was obligatory, that is, if you were hoping to pursue higher education or a career in government. Now the patriotic youth movement is making a comeback in Russia. It's happening at the same time that school curricula are being revamped. It's all part of an attempt to steer young Russians away from Western influence, prompted by a new law signed this month by President Vladimir Putin. To learn more, we reached out to Nina Khrushcheva. She's a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She's also the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, the first secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Ms. Khrushcheva joins us from Moscow. Professor, I just want to ask you first about your reaction hearing that old audio of those young pioneers. Was that part of your own political education?
Well, it was part of my education. It wasn't even political. It was obligatory. So there's no other choice. You are supposed to be a pioneer. But as for today, I was not surprised. I mean, I think the Putin administration for already two decades has been moving in that direction. In fact, I think in the early 2000s, there was already a textbook for smaller school children in which his portrait in the young pioneer red necktie, looking very much like young Lenin, was already inserted. So they were supposed to learn about Putin's greatness as a young pioneer once, and children were supposed to follow up.
So how do you see the gist of this new legislation? Is it an effort to turn back the clock in terms of how Russian youth understand and participate in politics? What is the intent?
The way at least the Kremlin sees it is that the United States have flags risen all over. They have the Pledge of Allegiance. They have all these things that exert Americanism. So why we can't do the same to exert Russianness? And if some of those features were in the Soviet Union, why not? That's not bad.
I mean, a lot of school-aged children, especially older ones, are exposed to other realities online. If this is basically an effort to shape how young people in Russia view their leaders, in particular Putin, is it likely to work?
I don't think so, although I was talking to some young people yesterday, it's about 20 to 25, and I said that probably it's not going to work because now it's formalized, and once it's formalized and there is no choice, then that's how the Soviet Union was shooting itself in the foot. And they were not agreeing with me. In fact, they were saying that the idea that Russia is being so mistreated by the West, and for that reason, we do need kind of a special ideological education, in fact, for some, is quite popular. I still think as a Soviet person, a year from now, they would be spitting and hating, and they would be watching via VPN TikTok videos at school somewhere in the bathroom. But for now, some people are very much against it, but some people are quite excited.
What sort of digital media literacy do most Russian youth have? Can most of them spot fake news and propaganda?
No. I mean, you know, and who can? I mean, please, I teach in the United States.
It is hard.
Americans can do that. Right. So no, of course they can't. They do have access. I mean, you can actually go on Facebook. You can have Instagram. I mean, it is a little bit annoying. It takes 1 minute to have the VPN working. The greater problem with propaganda and why in sort of this Putin's world TV works is because when they watch the other side and it's so angry against Russia, so ultimately you have to go to your own side. Because if you're so hated by everybody else, even if your own system, you are very critical, ultimately you would have to think, we cannot do all these horrible things because look at us, we have beautiful streets, we are kind to refugees who came from Donetsk and so on and so forth. So you choose your party in a sense. And that's something that actually has worked for Putin's propaganda.
I'm speaking with Professor Nina Khrushcheva about the revived Russian patriotic youth movement. Nina Khrushcheva, this law in Russia comes right in the midst of Putin's war on Ukraine. Is there a link, do you think, between this new emphasis on indoctrinating youth and the war in Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is all about the war in Ukraine. It's all about the war, period. I'm in Moscow now, so I walk around and, you know, the paintings on buildings, and they're all about victories in 16 whatever or defending the motherland in, I don't know, 1200 something. And there are all these laws now to make sure that nobody has a peep out of that militaristic system that after 22 years, Putin finally has been able to install.
Will this new movement likely be prominent in Crimea or newly occupied areas of Ukraine?
They would have to. In Crimea, it's already flourishing, and I'm sure it will be even more. So all these young children who will be told that they're liberated because they're no longer, if they're Nikolai, they're going to be Nikolai rather than Ukrainian Mykola, God forbid. In fact, even last year, they were lectures on what the intent in this special military operation in Ukraine was. Now it's part of the textbook. Now it's part of the curriculum, and it becomes part of the historic, heroic narrative of Russia's military greatness that always is a victim of the West and therefore always has to defend itself. And I mean, I personally did not think in the 21st century, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, after all the things we've learned about KGB, about Stalin, about injustices of Russian and Soviet history, we're going to be back at square one.
Nina Khrushcheva, there are, of course, big battles going on here in the U.S., your adopted country, about what is and isn't taught in schools, especially when it comes to history. Do you see parallels between these efforts to revamp curriculum in Russia and the U.S. at the moment?
Yes, I do. I think the time now is of a revolution. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement was a revolution. I mean, what Putin did, in a sense, was, I personally call it a palace coup. But yes, I think in general terms, the world is moving towards liberalism and sort of more diversity and screaming about it. And then the world that kind of represents the old and talks about traditional values and traditional color of skin and so on, traditional gender, is fighting like hell against it. And I think that is centrifugal, and centrifugal forces happen all over the world. But because Russia and the United States are such a giant pieces of land, it's probably visibly and more pronounced there than in other smaller places.
Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, is a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She's the author of several books, including In Putin's Footsteps. She joined us from Moscow to talk about new efforts to steer Russian youth away from Western influence. Very good to speak with you. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that, my friends, is where we leave you today. The World Broadcast from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.